Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Welcome to the Billboard Chartbeat Podcast. Gary Trouse, Billboard Senior Director of Charts.
And hey guys, it's Trevor Anderson, a chart manager here at Billboard.
All right, lots to get to this week. We're going to talk Lil Nas X on the Billboard Hot 100. We're going to go all the way back 20 years to 1999. We're going to really get in deep with a couple guests this week. So Andrew Unterberger from Billboard's edit staff is going to join us to talk pop music and really everything for 1999. But we feel like we've been talking about this for, I guess, at least the last couple of weeks. But I saw Mariah Carey at Radio City Music Hall a couple of weeks ago. Trevor, you finally saw her in Philly last week, right?
Okay, yeah. Well, it finally happened. Didn't get too mauled by too many people, but it was a nice evening out.
And joining us, our executive editor, first time on the podcast, Ross Scarano.
Welcome. Thank you for having me.
So you both were at the New York show.
Yeah, we were at the same show, Russ. We didn't actually realize it until later.
No, until much later. It was my third time seeing Mariah, though I feel like the first two times have asterisks next to them because they were for her Christmas shows. I've been to the Christmas show twice before where she does some of her non-holiday music, but it's mostly holiday songs. So it was the first time I had the opportunity to catch her touring for an album, which is very different than those Christmas shows.
I was actually upset that she didn't do at least All I Want for Christmas Is You. I know it's sorry, at the end of March, but it's my favorite Mariah song. I would have taken it.
I didn't get my favorite Mariah song either. I wanted Breakdown very badly. Yeah. You know, not everybody can like go there emotionally. I understand that.
I guess my favorite thing about this tour in general was that she, I don't know, didn't seem like she had much to prove with this album. And I mean that in a way that's like, obviously, Mariah Carey, you know, is a veteran, been there for so long, and it felt like this was a tour that she just really got to perform a lot of stuff that she hadn't gotten to in a while in a ways that she wanted to. It wasn't something she necessarily had to go out and, you know, prove she still had it for the critics or any sort of chip on her shoulder with that kind of thing. Like, I thought, I mean, obviously, the Justice for Glitter was something that she probably didn't see coming that really opened up the set list for her. Because, I mean, I can't imagine she's performed those songs from Glitter on tour ever, and just for her to have that moment, whereas, you know, probably some songs that she really, you know, really liked and really believed in, and to have a moment for that, like things like that, I thought that made this one kind of stand out for her.
Yeah, I was going to say, and Russ, you can back me up or not. I felt like the energy in Radio City got to its highest point during the whole Justice for Glitter part, because it kind of felt like that was us against the world. We knew these songs were good, and it just kind of felt like we were right all along. And it was great to hear these songs because she doesn't usually do them, and just kind of just seemed to take the emotion to a different level.
Yeah, I agree, and I think you're right. It's because there is this sense of like the audience was involved in it. Like all of a sudden, the spotlight was on everyone who helped participate in championing that album and defending that album. Just in general, like the energy level, though, I found to be really high, especially compared to the holiday shows where, you know, when I saw her, she was like so tightly constricted by her outfits that she wouldn't move without the assistance of like no less than like five or six men.
I heard about this. That's crazy.
Yeah, but she was so mobile, for lack of a better word.
She can walk.
During the Radio City shows. Now, she was like, she was moving around the stage it just with so much freedom that it was, you know, that was like inspiring in its own way.
Only part that was weird for me, maybe seeing like the shirtless dancer, like, I mean, there was a lot of that, and that's fine. I don't know, just something about like just the fact that I guess maybe because Mariah doesn't dance, like, threw me off in terms of just like, that is Mariah Carey just like standing between these like two super buff black like 20-year-old guys like who are like doing all these flips and tricks around her.
Like, it could have just been a green screen.
I mean, in a way, it almost just felt like, I don't know, if like my mom would, like, it was just like. What's happening with this dynamic? That was the only part that really, maybe that was just trying to be, I don't know, hip or too cool or whatever. That was the one thing that kind of threw me off over the course of the show. Talented guys.
Other than the Justice for Glitter part, I think what hit me as a highlight was vocally. Overall, I just thought her vocals were really, really strong. And I guess just not knowing where she was at this point, I haven't seen her at this point in about 10 years. That really impressed me, maybe most of all.
Yeah. I agree. She was just present in every way. She was present physically. Her voice was present. And she was just like, she seemed to be genuinely enjoying herself.
And she probably has a challenge that almost or very few other artists have because of the range she's hit over the years and put these songs on record.
No, I mean, in fact, when you read her press from around then, like there was a New York Times profile of her right before or right as Emotions was coming out. And she's talking about how she doesn't want to tour because the songs are so strenuous. So even then, it's kind of like she's assuming, like, I'm not going to have a typical career in that sense. Like, I understand that the work I'm doing is more intense than maybe the average, like, pop star. And so I'm going to treat my voice and my abilities accordingly. It's fascinating to read some of these old, like, profiles with her.
I don't know about you guys. I actually was kind of surprised at how short the set kind of was. I mean, it's only about an hour and a half, I think, which I expected it to just be longer. By the time I think We Belong Together was the next to last song, it felt like, what, like, because I heard beforehand that was going to be the next to last song, so I kind of was like, whoa, it's already timed for all of this. And maybe that's just part of having such a big catalog where it feels like there's a lot more hits that could have been played. Maybe that's also a thing with, you know, you don't want to overextend yourself vocally. So for her to sort of reduce it to managing a show she can deliver consistently every night. But I kind of actually really felt myself like wishing there had been about three or four more numbers that I really could have enjoyed.
That's not a bad problem to have. I think most shows go on for too long. So I kind of enjoy a show that maybe leaves me like wanting to go like walk out on the street and listen to one or two more on my headphones and like have that moment. You know, I think that can be kind of nice.
That's a perfect segue for the probably at least hour left of the Sharpie podcast. We don't know how to leave people wanting more.
No, I'm sure they get their fill by the time this is all said and done.
All right. Ross, we'll have to have you back. You're planning to go for another holiday show in December?
Yeah, I'd love to. I mean, they're always a blast, and it's a good way to usher in that season. So invite me back.
All right. From Mariah to this week's Top 10 on the Billboard Hot 100.
10, 9, 8. 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Number 10.
I just poured something in my cup. I've been wanting something I can feel. Promise I am never letting up. Money in your palm will make you real.
Number 9.
I wanna raise your spirits. I want to see you smile.
Number 8.
I'm a sucker for you. Say the word and I'll go anywhere blindly. I'm a sucker for you. Yeah. Any road you take, you know that you'll find me. I'm a sucker for all the subliminal things no one knows about you. About you. About you. About you. And you're making the typical me break my typical rules. It's true. I'm a sucker for you.
Number 7.
I'm that bad type, make your mama sad type, make your girlfriend mad type, might seduce your dad type. I'm the bad guy.
Duh.
Number 6.
Please me, baby. Turn around and just tease me, baby. You got what I want and what I need, baby.
Let me hear you say,
please.
Let me hear you say,
please.
Number 5.
So you can take advantage of me. Tell me how it feels sitting up there. Feeling so high, but too far away to hold me. You know I'm the one who put you up there.
Number 4.
It's a moment when I show up, God, I'm saying wow. 100 bands in my pocket, it's on me. Yeah, your grandma more probably know me. Get more bottles, these bottles are lonely. It's a moment when I show up, God, I'm saying wow.
Number 3. Number 2.
Then you're left in the dust. Unless I stuck by you. You're a sunflower. I think your love would be too much. Or you'd be left in the dust.
And number 1.
Yeah, I'm gonna take my horse to the old town road. I'm gonna ride till I can't no more. I'm gonna take my horse to the old town road. I'm gonna ride till I can't.
I got the horses in the bag. Horse stock is attached.
Okay, so if you haven't read about this by now, wow, what? Where have you been? We all know it. We love it. Do we even need to say what that is? Sure, because for consistency's sake, that was the only song in the world at this point. Old Town Road by Lil Nas X is, look at that, without even needing all that help from the remix, number 1 this week on the Billboard Hot 100. I'm sure in my new homepage, which is twitter.com/LilNasX, has been all over that this week. I've been there a lot. all right, so before we dive into what just got birthday boy Lil Nas X, today we're recording April 9th. It's actually his birthday,
that's
so
right.
Look at that. We're going to bring in one of our favorite guests we have on the podcast, Billboard senior editor Andrew Unterberger is back again. Let's give him a round of applause as he joins us. Yay!
Oh, thank you, Trevor. You're too kind, truly. What did Lil Nas X turn? He turned 20 or turned 21?
I believe he turned 20.
He turned 20.
Yes, he was born in 1999.
Good tie-in, 1999.
Yes.
Celebrating 1999 week every week, Lil Nas X. Yeah.
So, if you haven't seen the song, what are you doing? Number 1 this week on streaming songs because everybody cannot get enough of it. We're talking 46.6 million streams for the week. Third best-selling song of the week as well. Pulling out and this is actually decently impressive these days, 22,000 downloads. For those who are wondering, yes, the monster will only get bigger. Because as many of you know, as you should know by now, once again, if you don't know this song, what are you doing with your life? There's the remix with Billy Ray Cyrus that came out last Friday. And because it came out last Friday, actually for the sales and streaming purposes, that is not reflected in the number one this week. So this is all pre-Billy Ray Cyrus, essentially. If you've been paying attention to anything on YouTube or iTunes or twitter.com/LilNasX, you will know that the remix is blowing up even bigger than the original. So if you are a betting person, I would call your bookie and suggest Lil Nas X will probably be hanging around number one very much so next week.
Betting on a horse?
Yeah.
It took me a second, Gary.
Thank you.
Isn't he?
That was a little bit of a two-stepper.
Two-step horse. I guess that kind of is a nice sort of, way to bring in the elephant in this conversation.
Airplay 2 is building. Number 23 on rhythmic songs, number 30 on pop songs. And yes, a new number 53 on country airplay. And if you've been following this whole story, it's Billboard's sort of been a part of this story. So the song, sort of. So to recap, the song spent a week on our Hot Country Songs chart. in March at number 19, the first week it came out, first week it charted. And yeah, as we've said in a lot of different stories, there's a lot of different stories posted now on Billboard.com. It charted before we really had a chance to vet it more thoroughly than we normally would. It was tagged as a country song in iTunes, so it came through that way. And yeah, there's been a lot of discussion of should it have been on, should it have come off? And what we've pretty much been saying is we always want to have the most informed opinion of where a song should be on a chart. And Hot Country Songs is a chart where we actually have to make the designation of what fits genre-wise. So with a lot of talk with people in the industry and just further discussions and seeing iTunes later flag it as hip-hop, yeah, we made an informed decision. We'd rather maybe in some ways take some heat, but make a decision we believe in. And yeah, that's where we've stood on that. We don't know. It's not necessarily an irreversible decision, especially with the remix coming out with Billy Ray Cyrus. So yeah, that's kind of where it stands on all those angles. I'll say I think it's a great discussion, honestly, to be having. It's a fun song, and anything that challenges genre boundaries, that's what moves music forward.
And the really interesting thing, I think, is that you saw this at the ACM Awards. You know, we had a reporter there who was kind of pulling the audiences outside. Not by pulling audiences, I mean like interviewing some of the biggest artists in country music on the red carpet. And it seemed like a pretty split decision on whether or not the song should be counted as country. You had people like Florida Georgia Line and I feel like one or two other kind of prominent country artists saying, yeah, sure. I think Low Cash maybe saying, yeah, sure. Like it's got country elements. It's got the spirit of country. What is country anyway? It's a constantly shifting format. There's room for it. There's room for kind of left to center ideas in country music and for expanding definitions and things like that. And yeah, sure, we love the song, but bring it on. And you had other artists saying like, hey, this isn't country music. We're not casting aspersions on the song. We're not casting aspersions on the artist. But country music is a specific set of kind of signifiers and sonic standards. And this song doesn't really fit it. And look, there's plenty of other like really great country artists out there who are trying to get exposure in this landscape that aren't getting what they deserve. So what's this guy who has kind of one country leaning song and is otherwise more of a traditional hip hop artist? Why is he complaining about not getting recognized as country? And, I see both sides of it. I don't think it's a cut and dry decision. I think there's a lot of play here. And I think that, I was in favor of kind of talking about it as a country song because I think it's interesting. I think it is interesting to keep expanding definitions and to keep having that conversation. But, especially before the Billy Ray Cyrus remix, they're right that this isn't a traditional country song in a lot of ways. I think that If you asked a lot of people, if you pulled a room of 100 people and played in the song, and you asked them, is it a country song or is it a hip-hop song? I think most of them would say hip-hop song. Maybe 75, 80% of them would probably say hip-hop song at least.
And one person in that room would believe in Lady Gaga.
That is true. But then again, this is the kind of hard decisions that having the charts in this way force Billboard to make, which is that you have to kind of say it's one or the other, even though I don't think anybody would say no, it's 0% a country song or no, it's 100% a hip hop song or vice versa. Unless you want to start having songs on both charts, and I don't know what kind of rules we allow for that. You guys would know better than I would.
No, you can be on multiple charts.
All right, that's part of the discussion too, I'm sure. But again, you do have to kind of hard and fast say, is this enough of a country song to be on the country charts or not? And that's a decision. Yeah, it's not a black or white decision. It's not a
poor choice of words
there. But it's not a cut and dry decision. So let's go with that.
Yeah.
There obviously are elements of race at play here. There are elements of demographic and genre at play here. In terms of is it. Uncomfortable to be excluding someone for being a rap artist from the country charts, does that open you to all sorts of other sort of discussions to be had? But as you say, it's an evolving discussion, and I'm glad that we're not necessarily being dogmatic about it one way or the other, and that this is a discussion we can continue having as elements of the song change, as the Billy Ray Cyrus remix becomes more prominent, as more country stations start to play the song, as I sort of predicted they would, because now the song is just so massive that everyone kind of wants a piece of it.
Yeah. So the song is on Columbia Records proper, but now Sony Music Nashville is starting to look into whether they should promote it. Again, same kind of thing, trying to take the temperature.
I mean, you can't hurt, I suppose. You're not going to ruin its credibility.
Right.
Trevor, I've had conversations with you about this, and you didn't seem to think it was a country song at first. Does the Billy Ray Cyrus remix change the equation for you significantly?
It can, and I guess part of that, in a weird way, is like is the structure of the song. Because most of the song is still intact as the Lil Nas X. But it's funny that you mentioned that because it's the fact, in a weird way, that Billy Ray Cyrus starts that song off. Because I feel like, you know, I'm sure there's probably some study out there. I'm going to hope there's a study out there that'll say that, you know, probably in the first 10 to 15 seconds of hearing a song, you probably have you're probably predisposed to classifying it in some sort of way from those first notes you hear, from the first vocal you hear. So the fact that Billy Ray Cyrus, like, sort of waltzes on first, maybe it's strategic, maybe it just happened to be that way. But then when I was hearing that for the first time, I thought, like, if I had just heard this song come on, I would have assumed for sure it was a country song, just because that's – without even knowing it's Billy Ray Cyrus, but just with the twang, with kind of the strumming banjo, like, okay, this is where it's going. That one to me is much more of a toss-up. I mean, I don't think it's – not a rap song, because even Billy Ray's verse is, you know, it's rap.
It's Florida Georgia Line-esque at the very least.
Yeah, I mean, it's not trying to shy away from the fact that he's not singing, but this is a tough one. I mean, it's like, I guess it could live in both worlds, obviously. It doesn't have to be country or hip-hop specifically, but that does complicate it, and I think going forward, that's going to be probably a big question to consider is how that goes. And then apparently there's a Young Thug remix coming maybe later this week as well, they're hinting. So how does that factor into where this song goes? But
in addition to, I mean, I agree with everything you were saying about how the first voice you hear in the song does kind of help define it a little bit, but also it's just a longer, kind of more fleshed out verse chorus song this way. And I mean, maybe it's just a question of kind of the associations we have with the SoundCloud era of short songs being more of a hip-hop phenomenon. Then you don't really hear sub-2-minute country songs. I can't think of one off the top of my head, certainly, and definitely not any that would be impacting the charts in any significant way. So the fact that the Billy Ray Cyrus remix kind of takes it to more of that like 3-minute range makes it more of a comfortable fit in the country genre, I think. I don't know whether that actually makes it inherently more of a country song, but it does kind of, you know, it checks more of the boxes that way, I would say.
I, one thing that's hitting me is I feel like we had a similar discussion and how it's evolved to a much deeper discussion just when Meant to Be by Florida Sure. Georgia Line and Bebe Rexha set the record 50 weeks at number one. A lot of people saying that's a pop song. That's not country. And that was a number one country airplay.
Somebody even wrote in, I'm reading on Twitter or something, that called it an EDM song, even. Yeah. They went that far. They went that far with it.
But what I think that points to is I think there's a level of country is very insular. Obviously, it's based in Nashville. All the artists or most of the artists are there. The labels are there. There seems to be more a protectiveness of the genre in country maybe than almost any other genre. So when something use the word threatens, but really it comes in and changes what the traditional sound is. And this goes back to the 70s too, when the outlaw movement. Anytime there's something that just sounds really different, it seems like it's really a lightning rod, especially for country.
Yeah, and for the record, I think that, in my opinion anyway, Old Town Road is 10 times more of a country song than Meant to Be was. And that's, I mean, it's interesting because obviously it was a very big country airplay hit. So country did sort of, you know, let it in the fences, as it were. But And we'll see if that happens too with Old Town Road. I think there's a pretty good chance that it will. But to me, that is a pop song with a country artist on it. Very kind of pretty clearly, I would say. Like in terms of the melody of it, in terms of the structure of it, and definitely in terms of the production, I would say that song has very little to what I consider to be kind of traditional country standards. I think the only thing about it that kind of gives it the ties to the country world is the sort of the twang of Florida Georgia Line's voice. But, I mean, when you talk about Old Town Road, you are talking about a lot of country signifiers. You are talking about a very kind of pronounced country, you know, affected accent, but an accent nonetheless. And you're talking about that kind of dusty instrumentation, which is, I think, like a more country evocative sound than anything that you actually hear in Meant to Be. So I think the people that say, you know, why would you consider Meant to Be a country song and not Old Town Road? I think they might have a point. And then that's just as much of a question for Nashville as it is for Billboard. But it's an interesting question.
I definitely think, well, it's like when you Wow. I was thinking about Gary's point about with Meant to Be. Because, yeah, it's funny how even in the past really decade, but even 4 or 5 years, sort of it feels like this narrative has shifted further and further in terms of I remember Body Like a Back Road was like the biggest country song. You know, it had the record before Meant to Be. And there were, you know, people giving side eye even to that record about, you know, okay, it's got, because it has like kind of the finger snap and the DJ Mustard A, and it borrows from hip hop, not maybe overtly, but you can tell that the taste is there. And is, are we going to really call this a country song? I mean, before that, you know, there was, I don't want to say a big controversy, but there was certainly discussion about Daddy Lessons with Beyonce in that same way about, and like Lil Nas X have brought up questions of race too about, you know, of course Beyonce's more established and she'd never really done anything country before, but if she goes in this way, are we going to allow her to be considered country? The Grammy committee voted no apparently against that. Guess the Dixie Chicks and the CMAs, but even that CMAs performance ruffled some feathers. People thinking she was stepping, you know, just getting out of her lane a little too much. She's queen of hip hop R&B. She's not about to take over our stage as well. And this kind of goes back even, I think, to Taylor Swift, who really blurred the line in the last decade about who is country, who is pop, what songs are going to be this and what songs are going to be that. But it's funny because I think, maybe, and I would love to hear your guys' perspective on this because you guys probably are much more in touch with the country landscape as more than I am. But it's interesting to me because when you talk about the insular country artists, it's funny. I think that if you sort of stripped away all of the fringe artists, the people who kind of dabble in the pop pond or whatever, it's almost like the country stars who are pure country in a way only appeal to, like, there's like a certain demographic they only appeal to. I'm not saying it's necessarily just like white people or older people, but I guess I can't think of like, I don't know, like there are mainstream country stars, but it feels like they're always that. They're country stars. They're just not like mainstream stars or pop stars or big acts. Like it's, so I wonder, I don't know if that's good or bad, but it just feels.
Yeah, what's happened traditionally is when country stars come up through country, if they go pop, like Faith Hill and Shania Twain, there's brushback from Nashville. How dare on some levels, you leave us, and Carrie Underwood, same kind of thing. There's a real protectiveness again. So artists are very cognizant of that. So I think a lot of artists decide to stay country because they realize this is working. I don't want to ruffle anything. What's interesting at the same time is it's always looked on as a little weird, a little unaccepted when you don't come the usual route. And I'm thinking back to Leanne Rimes. Mm. Back in 1996 with one of the most traditional sounding songs you'll ever hear for country, Blue.
Yodeling.
Because she was a young, maybe female artist, maybe there's a part of it with this Patsy Cline sounding song. Even that, it got to the top 10 on Hot Country Songs, but disappeared pretty quickly. She has never been an automatic country artist. So maybe if you just don't take the usual route through radio, through the ranks of the usual label route, Nashville just sometimes has some kind of an issue with that.
I agree with all of that, and it is interesting to see kind of what gets let in and what doesn't. And Nashville can definitely be a little bit too exclusionary sometimes with these things. But I do want to stick up a little bit for the Brothers Osbornes of the world here, because I don't think that their objection is with Lil Nas X or even Old Town Road as a song. I think it's more about the discussion around it and the volume of the discussion around it. Because I think they're sort of – what they want to say and what they are saying to a certain extent is, look, we do country 12 months out of the year, and we live in this world full time. Who are all these people coming down and saying this is country, this isn't country, and kind of weighing on our scene who maybe couldn't name a Brothers Osborne song or maybe don't really care about country most of the time? But everybody really is voicing an opinion here, and they're voicing loud opinions about what should happen, what should be considered country, what should be let in the gates. And whether or not they agree with that, I sort of understand them saying, like, this isn't even something that you care about most of the time. Why are you all of a sudden acting like this is the biggest deal in the world? So I do sort of get where they're coming from there. I don't necessarily agree with what they're saying for the most part. I do think that I think that there's room kind of for everybody, and I think that if their problem is with you know, why aren't the gatekeepers letting in these other people as well as Lil Nas X? And like, that's fair, but I think it's more of a problem with the gatekeepers than with Lil Nas X or Old Town Road themselves. But I also do understand their kind of frustration. You know, and they said themselves, like, we've been asked this question like a million times tonight. You know, this shouldn't be the only thing people are talking about with country music. There's a lot of stuff going on. There's a lot of people doing interesting things. Why is Lil Nas X suddenly sucking up all the oxygen? And I think that's reasonable.
Yeah, I think we'll see what country programmers do with it. That'll kind of drive the discussion for the next little bit. If country radio listeners want to hear this, that'll kind of maybe sway the decision more that, okay, country audiences find this a fit for their genre. So, yeah, I come back to this. It's a really fun discussion to be having. As much as Billboard's been maybe caught up in this in some ways, this is really a great point of what music does. It gets people talking about it so passionately.
Yeah, and I just want to say, like, because I feel like I worry sometimes that this will get lost in all the controversy. This is a great song. Like, this is a really interesting, yes, fun, innovative, new song.
Yeah.
That is both really subversive in a lot of ways and also just really catchy. Like, I find myself like humming two or three different parts of the song every day since it came out.
Yeah.
And I think the Billy Ray Cyrus remix is only expanding on that. And I love that the song got to number one without the Billy Ray Cyrus remix, because now we don't have to have the discussion of, oh, well, you know, we only let it in because of the Billy Ray Cyrus verse, and then he lent it some sort of credibility that it wouldn't have had otherwise. No, it was a great song before the Billy Ray Cyrus version, and it's a great song after it too.
I feel like I think that there are three points I want to throw out that are all sort of unrelated. But I mean, I will say, back to your point about the whole gatekeepers question, you know, part of this whole controversy is the concept and the idea that, you know, if black people never get credit for their country music contributions and virtually invented country music, it's very odd that now we have to go back all these years later and sort of appease to these new gatekeepers that please accept my song as country music. I'm not saying, you know, there is just that part of that, sure, argument as well. I think, yeah, working here, I was talking to people earlier today, and I kind of maybe alluded to this at the top of the segment, however many minutes ago, I can't really remember like more than just the number one on the Hot 100, but really like the last time it felt like there was really only one song in the world. Like, I mean, even if you look at the top 10, you know, there's Seven Rings, there's what? No, but I mean, it's like, I don't even think about any other song except Old Town Road. And I was like, when's the last? Because even with Despacito, it felt like I knew there were yes, it was the biggest song of the moment. It was the most important song, but it didn't feel like the only song. I guess maybe like I was thinking Hello by Adele was the last time that it felt like whether it was just what you saw on social media, the parodies, the memes, like it just, I can't remember the last time.
Bodak Yellow, maybe?
I was thinking Bodak was probably the one exception where it really felt like if you're going to put out a song for the next month, just don't. Like it will just get sucked into a black hole. We are focused on one thing and one thing only.
And I think the thing that this has that maybe Despacito and a couple of the other major number ones of recent years haven't is that it does have this kind of baked in discussion to it. And that, like, and then there's such a debate element to it that even people that aren't necessarily interested in the song as a song are interested in talking about this song. Like, I'm sure you guys have had this experience too, where you're having conversations about this song with people you'd never expect to know of, you know, who Lil Nas X is, yeah, or what Old Town Road is, or what charts it is or isn't currently qualifying for. It's unbelievable the amount of reach that this song has had in such a short period of time. And that's a testament to the song, and it's a testament to his ability to kind of stoke the conversation himself. I mean, Trevor, you alluded to his Twitter account earlier. It's a great Twitter account. Like, it's he's doing a great job of kind of keeping the conversation rolling, you know, and just kind of finding new ways to sort of refresh it every so often. You know, posting new videos that go along with it. Or, you know, posting kind of new memes that other people are creating that he's kind of helping to signal boost. It feels like every day there's something new to talk about with this song. And it's reaching corners of the universe that pop music doesn't always necessarily reach. And that's really interesting.
I can't remember the last time Billboard was so, prominent. I mean, in terms of, yeah, there's like, I mean, there's GMA segments and all these articles, and I saw it like on my Twitter moment, the Twitter moment, and, you know, all these people have weighed in about it. Yeah, I mean, if you didn't know we were here,
now you know.
If you don't know, now you know.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
So, Andrew, this is a big focus on Billboard.com this week. So, it's 1999 week.
Yeah. So, we did this last year first with 1998 in 2018. You know, the 20-year nostalgia cycle. It's a real thing, and it's a good. It's a, you know, I always sort of say that nostalgia is a little bit overrated, but just remembering good songs is underrated. I like doing lists like this that, you know, really force you to kind of dig into not just the absolute hugest hits of the period, but you know, some of the lesser remembered ones, some of the ones that maybe if you weren't around at the time you don't even know necessarily. But yeah, so we had a staff vote and we came up with our list of the 99 best songs in 1999.
Sorry, this is going to be ruined next year when I can't say it cleanly. Hundred of 2000
still works. Right. Still got the double O in there. I think that's pretty good. I don't know if we're going to keep going to 100 and 102 after that, but 100's a good round number for 2000.
Top 2000 songs of 2000?
Could you? Hey, look, I'm down. I don't know if we have the resources for that one, but
including mental capacity.
I guess we'll figure that out next year. But yeah, so we had a staff vote and we came up with our list. And I got to say, I think when you're doing one of these lists for a year, you know, just focusing on the kind of the cream of the crop, every year feels like a pretty special year. But this year, I can't tell you how many people came to me being like, oh, man, like, I can't believe how many great songs there are this year. This really feels like one of the defining pop years, certainly of my lifetime, probably of the Hot 100 era, I would say. You know, Gary, you've lived through more of these years than I have. You can correct me if I'm wrong. But when you look at some of the names and some of the songs, it just like even you look at it mathematically, like I was looking at you know, there's a service, Heelsonic, was one of the primary karaoke services, and they have like a weekly chart of what the most karaokeed songs in the country are. And three of the top 15 from last week come from 1999.
Yeah.
And so like that's sort of an objective way to kind of look at this and say like, man, like these songs endure in a way that not a lot of years have this many songs like that.
Yeah, when I was looking back at some of the biggest hits, what hit me is how many different genres were at such a high point. Obviously,
absolutely,
there's so much pop with NSYNC and Backstreet Boys and Britney and Christina, their breakout years. But the punk pop movement with mm-hmm. Blink-182, that felt like that was at such a great point. A lot of good R&B. Melodic R&B, we just don't hear those as mainstream hits anymore from Angel of Mine, Monica. It just seems like every genre you could hit and country, all the Faith Hill, Shania Twain mm-hmm. crossover stuff. So, yeah, I think it was a good year, not just for pop music, but maybe because in pop music, because there were so many different sounds.
Yeah, and not only those just mega hits by mega artists, but a lot of weird one-offs too. Yeah, stuff like, Len Steal My Sunshine or the Baz Luhrmann song, Everybody's Free to Wear Sunscreen, yeah. Or like Eiffel 65's Blue Dabba Dee. Like just these songs that came out of nowhere don't seem to be rooted to any place or genre or even moment in time, but they still become like a very big part of the year's DNA just because like, oh man, like that couldn't have happened in any other year.
It was a lot of fun music too.
Oh, yeah.
Lou Bega, Mambo Number
That's
5.
A great example
Maybe
too,
that
for
speaks
sure.
to pop culture at the time, but a lot of just really happy, upbeat, silly type songs.
Yeah, and in sort of less happy, sort of feel good modes there was you know, the rise of new metal as well, which was sort of, at least at the time, it felt like a reaction to kind of the sort of bright sunshine Florida pop that was dominating top 40 and TRL and pretty much everywhere in between. then you had artists like Korn and Limp Bizkit and Orgy, who are all on this list too. And, you know, as a 12, 13-year-old boy at the time, I wasn't necessarily feeling, you know, sunshine, lollipops, and rainbows all the time. So it was good to have that sort of release valve of, you know, that's not necessarily the most constructive of rock music in terms of, you know, social dynamics and you know, being politically correct and all that. But at the time, it was a good release for very suburban and predictable teenage angst. So
if only you had Billie Eilish back then.
Yeah, really. That would have all set. I've been pretty serious.
All right. Should we do what we've done on the podcast before when we have some of these deep discussions? The Fishbowl podcast.
I definitely. Although I do first want to ask you guys, what do you think of the number one? I guess for the folks listening at home, that's a very tight race for the number one spot, but ultimately awarded to Britney Spears for Baby One More Time. And I should say that the song was technically released in 1998, but we made allowances on this list that songs were eligible for this list if they either debuted on the Hot 100 within the 1999 calendar year or hit number one for the first time on the Hot 100 within the 1999 calendar year. And obviously, Baby One More Time was in 1999 number one, so that was eligible and awarded by our staff the number one pick over a couple other really heavy hitters in TLC's No Scrubs and Backstreet Boys' I Want It That Way. So I'd say of those three songs, would you have gone with this? And if not, is there another one maybe lower down the ballot that you would have opted for instead?
Personally, I'd take number 87, Amy Mann. Save me.
Shockingly, Gary, that was not as much of a consensus favorite. Did not quite have the reach of a Baby One More Time, but I'm sure it kills your karaoke nights.
I'm happy it's on there. No, I think I Want It That Way at number three. I think that might be the most perfect pop song on this list and really just one of the most perfectly crafted pop radio hits ever. But in terms of the way Britney just came in, it changed pop culture and it being her debut hit and how I think she's probably influenced a whole generation since. It's a pretty solid number one.
I do agree that, you know, how nice to sort of look back, and I don't think anybody, unless you were really, really, really ahead of the curve, understood what Britney Spears would come to represent in the pop music landscape. And when you look at so many people who, you can say, followed in her footsteps or either were her contemporaries, I mean, she always kind of has been the queen of that movement. I mean, that makes sense, I guess, I feel like Britney
Spears. Is this all a wind-up to you saying that you don't like Baby One More Time?
No, I do. Well, I was going to say, I do like Britney Spears. It's almost like Britney Spears herself eclipses more than just Baby One More Time. I would not have put that song as my, you know, if it's just what's supposed to be, I guess, the best song of 1999.
Mm-hmm. Well, the greatest song, I think, is the official title.
Greatest song.
So to me, at least, that combines both best and most important.
Okay, if we're going to go with greatest, then okay, I can give that. If we're going best, I myself would have picked the song that I put atop my ballot, which was Lauryn Hill's X Factor. Mm,
it was also my number one, for the record.
Pulls at the heartstrings. Well, I mean, if you want to talk about it's not a pop song in terms of let's make this a hit, but just a song that I don't know, you can just put that on at any point in time and it just endures. Not only, I'm sure, of course, Drake gave it a nice revival last year with Nice For What. So if you didn't know it, now you know it. But just the original stuff, just a beautiful composition, really.
You know, I totally agree. I was thinking the other day about whether or not that's the best soul song released in my lifetime. I think if it isn't, it's certainly in the discussion. X Factor, it's a perfect heartbreak ballad. It's certainly one of my favorite songs of all time. It was my personal choice for number one, but I don't think necessarily has the cultural weight to be number one on a list like this. If for no other reason than because, you know, it was the second single off the album. The album was released in 1998. It didn't quite have the same sort of pop impact that doo-wop did certainly the year before, which was even higher on our list than the next factors on this year's list for 1998. And it also just didn't, I don't know, Baby One More Time, like you can see the entire future of pop music just kind of stemming directly from that song.
You ain't got to defend it to me.
All right, I'm just saying. But also, I do think that Baby One More Time is a great pop song, and it's a song that I do have a lot of personal affection for. That maybe even kind of more than I did back in 1999, as I've come to sort of appreciate the science behind it in a way that I wasn't really sort of able to grasp when I was 12 or 13 years old. But certainly, you'll hear no protest from me about X Factor being the best song from this year. I think that's a very strong argument.
All right, let's get into the Fishbowl, which people can't see this. Our Fishbowl is actually an upside down Boston Red Sox cap.
Gary always got to represent when given the opportunity.
So it's cursed, as you already know.
not after 1999. Up through 1999, maybe. But so what we'll do is we'll just reach in, pick out topics, and see what we come up with.
What's your favorite 1999 hit by a former boy band member? So there's a bunch in contention here. We actually have an article about this that's either running later today or early tomorrow. But it's a big year for former boy band members. It was a huge year for contemporary boy band members. But also it was the year that that Jordan Knight had his solo breakthrough with Give It to You. And also Joey McIntyre, his New Kids on the Block bandmate with Stay the Same. Robbie Williams to Take That finally had his U.S. Moment, which was some sort of brief and short-lived, but encompassed Angels and Millennium, two pretty good songs. And certainly the most popular bunch, Ricky Martin, formerly of Menudo, had both Livin' La Vida Loca, certainly one of the biggest hits of that year, and She's All I Ever Had, which probably doesn't get remembered as well, but was the number two hit at the time. So so you got your pick of those, Gary. Which are you going for?
Yeah, well, as much as I was just talking Boston, I really want to vote for Joey McIntyre, Stay the Same.
That's a very Gary pick.
Great ballad. But I guess if I'm being true to what I thought at the time, and it is such a great song. Yeah, Ricky Martin, Livin' La Vida Loca. But I'd also maybe Justice for both of these two songs. She's All I Ever Had.
That's a great one.
Number two hit, co-written by John Cicada, by the way, 90s. Sure. Big hit maker in the 90s. Also, the album cut on the Ricky Martin album with Madonna, Be Careful, which was never a single. I know we've talked about this before in the podcast, how Madonna had a duet with Prince on Like a Prayer that was never a single. Two of the biggest artists at the time, 1999.
Justice for Madonna.
Yeah. Ricky Martin, one of the biggest artists of 1999. Duet with Madonna, also not a single.
Spoiler alert, but we do have a deep cuts, an accompanying deep cuts list of 1999 that's coming later in the week to complement the singles list that we have with kind of the overall, but top 99. And Be Careful by Ricky Martin and Madonna may or may not play a part in that one.
Yeah.
Trevor?
I gotta give some love to the Jordan Knight song for sure. Which I only found out recently, as the internet kind of found out recently, co-written by Robin Thicke.
21-year-old Robin Thicke.
Yes, a very, very young Robin Thicke. Also, I don't have a soft spot in my heart for any Jam Lewis collaboration. I had a phase for a little bit, maybe a couple years ago, where I was back in Livin' La Vida Loca, I will say. It's funny because it's not a great vocal performance. Like, for some reason, I guess back when you were a kid, you know, it felt like anybody who was on a record was the best, you know, you've got, of course. And I hear back, I'm like, okay, like, this was an easier song, I guess, than I thought it was. But of course, I mean, it's the personality that sells that record, like, you know, 10 times over. And I feel like you can't not like that song. And even though it is kind of lame, but even some of the lyrics about like the,
skin's the color mocha.
Yes. Like, I feel like mocha is one of the, like, I think it was like where I first learned the word mocha. I was like,
it's a very forced rhyme.
What rhymes with loca? A lot of choices.
But even that, like, that's one of those things that you cringe at the time, and 20 years later, just like, Ricky Martin.
Yeah,
you scamp. I'll also vouch for Give It to You, and I'll also shout out Robbie Williams' Millennium, which is a fun song, samples Nancy Sinatra's You Only Live Twice. Yeah. Not a classic, maybe, but a fun song at the time.
All right, how about this one? 1999 Comeback Player of the Year, non-Santana, non-Cher division.
Oh,
too easy. Ooh. Santana, believe.
All right, I'll say one off the bat. So this might step on another one of my answers later, but the one that I find the most fascinating many years later is Pearl Jam's Last Kiss. So a comeback is maybe a strong, you know, they had released the Yield album the year before, which is a pretty big album in the rock sphere. Didn't really have a major crossover appeal, didn't really have much in the way of top 40 hits or MTV hits. And their album before that, No Code, was sort of the album that kind of ended Pearl Jam's career superstar. So when you were looking at them in 1999, you were thinking of them as pretty much like a genre band. They're an alt-rock band. They have a big core audience. Their days is like one of the most important bands out there, probably over the days of them being played all the time on MTV or on Top 40 radio, definitely over. And then here they come with this fan club single, and not even the A side of the fan club single, the B side of the fan club single is a cover version of, I don't remember the original artist, but the artist that had the famous version of it was J. Franklin Wilson and the Cavaliers, a 60s death ballad called Last Kiss. And it's a live version of the song. It's got kind of this raw Eddie Vedder vocal performance. And it's this very slow 60s style ballad. And for some reason that I will never be able to totally understand, radio just can't get enough of this song.
Well, I was in radio at the time. It's so catchy. It's just a catchy pop song.
It is, but it's not a catchy pop song the same way that I Want It That Way is. It's not a catchy pop song the way that No Scrubs is. It's a catchy pop song the way that J. Franklin Wilson and the Cavaliers and their ilk were 35 years earlier. So what was it about this song that just made it so undeniable?
Well, we played it because people liked it.
So. Okay, give the people what they want, Gary. I suppose just, that's fair enough.
I think it was probably part of it, I guess, looking back, is you wouldn't expect a song that's – what's weird is the song is so happy musically and so sad lyrically. So it's this weird mix. But overall, I guess when I think of that song, I sort of think of just the happy beat about it. And I think maybe people didn't think of it that deeply. They're just like, catchy song. I know that voice, yeah. Eddie Vedder. Sure.
I guess that's fair enough. And 12-year-old me probably didn't look at it as askance as I do as a 30-something. But it went to number 2 on the Hot 100. And that's higher than Jeremy. That's higher than Alive, Even Flow, Better Man. All these songs, which were like the biggest alt-rock hits of my entire life. And this fluke B-side live cover is their defining legacy on the Billboard Hot 100. It's crazy to me.
Yeah, it's funny. If you look at Nirvana and Pearl Jam together, because they're so often linked, Nirvana's biggest hit on the Hot 100 is Smells Like Teen Spirit. Totally fitting, sure. Most people would say. For Pearl Jam, it's Last Kiss.
Yeah, sure. Why not? Two equally important and pivotally cultural songs. Absolutely. So what about you, Gary? Well, while Trevor's still a surgeon here, what's your pick for this?
Yeah, well, I guess I'll go with two, but my main one, and maybe not so much again a comeback, but his biggest adult contemporary hit, Phil Collins, with You'll Be in My Heart.
Sure. That's
from Tarzan.
Yeah, good answer.
And also in this really shows, really tells you 1999, Gloria Estefan had her biggest hit in a long time. Music of My Heart, it's a good ballad.
Do you think NSYNC even remember that they were on that song?
It got her name to number 2 on the 100, which made me
God
happy.
Bless her for it.
And what I know, I keep mentioning Amy Mann, but Save Me from the same year, it was up for the Oscar, and Phil Collins won. And afterwards, I've seen her in concert so many times. She would always refer to You'll Be in My Heart as that monkey love song that I lost to.
And I got to say, I've never been a fan of You'll Be in My Heart, but I do like Son of Man.
That's the one.
That's the one. That's absolutely correct.
Two Worlds is great too.
Yeah, a lot of every song on that album is better than You'll Be in My Heart. I have no idea why that was a single, but it certainly struck a nerve. People younger than me tend to love it. People my age actually love it too. It must just be me. But yeah, I'm totally with you on Save Me. That's one of my favorite songs from this year. Should have won.
Oh, okay. Okay, I guess in the spirit of picking one of our own. Oh, God, I probably shouldn't have said that because now the stands are going to come for me. All right, both got their first solo number one in 1999. Are you Team Brandy or Team Monica?
Gary, you want to answer first or should I?
Now, then, forever.
Well, I already mentioned Angel of Mine, so I don't know if I'm team either person, but I guess team songs of that year. I always thought,
That's
as far as I'm going.
Not team songs.
I'm on Team Angel of Mine.
Yeah, I think 499. Actually, both of these artists released one of my favorite songs of theirs this year. But Monica's was the bigger hit. Angel of Mine is, I think, one of the most underrated love songs of the last 20 years. I wrote about it for the list, but it's got this really like Smokey Robinson quality to the lyrics, where like it kind of expresses a lot in very very simple phrasing and beautiful chorus, fun video, and almost Doesn't Count by Brandy is kind of one of her most underrated songs. It wasn't as big a hit on the Hot 100, it was like in the low teens or 20s maybe, but it's just a really kind of good defeated heartbreak song. I didn't like Have You Ever, like the big Brandy hit from this year. It's a very melodramatic song. It doesn't really stick with you the way that her other songs do, I don't think. On the whole, Brandy versus Monica, I'd say Brandy probably has more songs that I like on the whole, but she also just had, I think, maybe a little bit longer career, a little bit more pronounced the presence at the time. So I think she's got the overall numbers, but for 99, I give it to Monica.
I'm actually going to make a call. I'm going to say Monica. Because I just remembered she did a cover of Richard Marx's Right Here Waiting.
She did. That she did.
Well, what about you, Trevor? Now you got to...
Ooh, that's tough.
You got to proclaim your allegiance this year.
I know. I feel like I almost need to go Team Brandy, but I will say between... I guess if I have to stack up the albums that they were associated with this year, which was Never Say Never for Brandy, Boy Is Mine... which Monica playing off that marketing. I will say I think Boy Is Mine is probably a better album. I think in particular, if you haven't heard the cut Misty Blue, that it's a cover
of an old soul classic. I mean, Monica also, and Brandy was obviously very young too, but I keep forgetting, both of these women, not even, you know, 20, they're still 17, 18 when they're doing Boy Is Mine, when they're doing all these hit songs. So I know it's, at least for me, I guess, once I was a kid, it felt like they had to be in their 20s, you know, they're adults. And I think they were just barely out of high school. I mean, I think that is so, so crazy. So yeah, for this moment, I got to give it to Team Monica. I do, yeah, first album, I probably would go Brandy if I compare their debuts, but yeah, at this point, Monica, I'll say.
I think we all know what sizes of paper we
yeah,
were.
That's,
I think we're all picking our own.
That's where we fucked up.
I'm glad this one came up, though. Yeah. On a scale of 10 to 10, how great are the South Park Bigger, Longer, and Uncut songs?
Lame Canada. What would Brian Boitano do?
I guess that could work. We have to try. What would Brian Boitano do if he was here right now? He'd make a plan and he'd follow through. That's what Brian Boitano do.
When Brian Boitano was in the Olympics skating for the gold.
What would Brian Boitano do is the best song on there. It's a great song.
It's a bop. It's a real bop. I mean, Madden Trey, I think, just to even execute that concept is so, it's just so impressive. And yeah, I mean, it's funny because I know people... And I remember at the time, of course, there was no way I could watch that. I was like 8 when it came out. So, you know, we all heard about it, but we never saw it. But yeah, just it's always funny to me how, and maybe it's less surprising now with Book of Mormon being such a success too, is people forget how talented those two guys are, just in terms of, yes, they can do outlandish things, and yes, they can have weird senses of humor, or sometimes are, of course, offend many people, but they, just like any good comedian, they understand all the elements that make any type of show work, and for them to write this musical with, like you said, actually good songs, like well crafted, not just some
Michael McDonald on the soundtrack too, real legitimate artists.
Yeah, like I think that's just a huge milestone for them. I'm very interested to see what Andrew has to say about this, because I think he probably
oh boy
knows this. So 1999, we have maybe we should pause to remember, really, on a really 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 serious note. Let's not forget. The Columbine High School Massacre happened in 1999. And, you know, a lot of people at the time were pointing the fifth finger at the goth scene, at Marilyn Manson, and a lot of, you know, rock music in general, in a lot of ways, anything hard. Do you think in the 20 years since that scene has recovered to any level of prominence close to what it was? Or do you think it's, in some ways, you know, because these events haven't stopped happening, sort of permanently suppressed in a way that it will never quite get back to what it once was?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think this is one of the most interesting things to talk about in 1999. We actually have something coming this week that's sort of along these lines, an essay from a freelancer. But the interesting thing about the way that rock music was sort of blamed for the Columbine attacks is that, I mean, I don't think the kids took it that seriously. I don't think that the people that would have been buying these albums anyway suddenly stopped because they were like, oh, I don't want to support this music because, you know, it causes violence. I mean, that's never the way kids have reacted to anything about popular culture in the last, you know, since Elvis, basically. So I don't think that was the case, and I don't even know if the parental outcry that surrounded it had much of an impact on rock music. But this does end up being basically the last year that rock music is the music you listen to piss off your parents. And I think there's a couple of reasons for that. I think Columbine's a part of it, maybe. I also think that Woodstock 99 and kind of the fallout from that, where you have, you know, Fred Durst not necessarily inciting violence from the stage, but basically telling people to be pissed off and don't listen to what Alanis Morissette says, listen to what we say. And then you have the Red Hot Chili Peppers covering Jimi Hendrix's Fire, and people are literally setting fires in the audience. And you have, if you ever read the reporting from that period, it's Sodom and Gomorrah out there. It's rapes. It's drug overdoses. It sounds basically like hell on earth, and kind of the hard rock of the period. And hard rock was kind of having a moment that year. Does sort of, and not only does it get blamed for it, but it kind of gets stained by it. And then the other thing that happens that year is Eminem comes out, and suddenly Eminem is the most vile music on the planet. And it's the music that kids listen to, and their parents go, oh, well, I didn't let you buy that CD, and then you know they hide it in their bedroom drawer or whatever. And suddenly he becomes the paragon of, you know, a rebellious teenage suburbia, and he's a rapper. And he says, "I don't want to be associated with rock music." He says, "I'm a rapper, and stop trying to get me to sing rock music, and stop trying to put me in that box because that's not what I am. I'm hip hop." And then from the 20 years after that, hip hop is the kind of the voice of young America.
And it already sort of was up to that point, but they'd never had a figure like Eminem. I mean, it should be said, a white figure certainly appeals to some of the same audiences that Limp Bizkit and Korn would have a year before. And he becomes the biggest thing on the planet going into the 21st century, and he only gets kind of more volatile and becomes more of a lightning rod from there. And then you flash forward to 20 years from now, to 20 years later, to where we are now. And the most rebellious music, the most kind of besieged music from the parental advisory crowd are, you know, people like XXXTentacion and 6ix9ine and even Juice WRLD to a certain extent are the people that you listen to while you're sulking in your bedroom and while you're trying to, you know, pretend like nobody understands you and the only person in the universe that has these problems. That's the kind of music you listen to. It's not rock music. You're not listening to 21 Pilots or Imagine Dragons thinking about that. So, and I do think it all kind of stems from 1999, where rock music kind of has its last grand stand as the music of young rebellious America, and then Eminem takes over, and then it's rap from then on out.
This is more sort of a lesson for me because, like I said, I'm not surprised. That's not my scene personally. I think that's an interesting point, and I especially with the point about Eminem, I didn't think about that until you brought it up. I knew hip hop was going to be part of the equation we were talking about when it became.
Mm-hmm. And it would have happened without Eminem anyway. Yeah. I mean, DMX did a lot of the same things too.
Yeah, but in a weird way, I mean, I don't know. There's something always kind of funny to me about how people appeal up and down. And for DMX, it's like, yes, DMX did the same kind of things. But for me, I always felt like DMX appealed to adults in a way. Like 20 year olds were buying DMX, 25 year old, like not necessarily my parents' age, but like somebody older. Like I mean, kids listen to DMX, but for some reason, I guess maybe just the people I was around were 6, 7, 8 years older than I was. Eminem definitely was like a guy who trended younger for whatever, you know, whatever reason people grabbed onto him. So, you know, I hate to sort of give him that much attention as like the lightning rod, but I mean, you're right. I mean, it certainly, and yes, the fact that he's a white guy and, you know, looks a certain way, and I know a lot of, you know, I mean, even it's funny because I know a lot of like suburban girls who thought he was so hot, and that's what got them into his music, and whatever it was about him that made everybody come around. Yeah, I mean, he definitely became certainly the most popular rapper on the planet, certainly the most despised rapper on the planet. I mean, this is a guy who, you know, I feel like even in all of basically like in all of black music, rap, soul, whatever, the mother is like a sacred, like, you know, like sacred figure, you know, like, I mean, everybody that loved their mama, they went through the hardest things with, you know, their mother was all the way for them. This is a dude talking about killing his mother, shoving her in, you know, in a trunk, in a ditch. I hate you, you bitch, you, like, so maybe that something about even in that element made it crazy, but, I think it's a good point that interestingly turned the century for rock music. And I forgot about Woodstock 99. I mean, that certainly gave it a terrible media perception. But all that to say, yeah, I think that's a great answer. I didn't expect that, honestly, like to be that thought out.
It's something I've been thinking about a lot recently anyway. And the other thing with Eminem is that he actively courted it. Like he's saying on his singles, like, don't you want to grow up to be just like me? You know, he's basically like, he's basically serving as kind of the Pied Piper for all the shitty 12-year-olds out there and saying, like, hey, like, come on, listen to my music, fuck shit up, yell at your parents, like, be a bad kid. Well, and that's the scariest thing imaginable to suburban America.
Well, also I think even more than sort of enticing, I think he does entice people for sure. But I remember that I guess in the end of The Real Slim Shady when he's like talking about, you know, there's a million out there who dress like me. Yeah. Like he already knows that, like, he is just what's already out there. Like, he doesn't even need to necessarily try to get people to his cause because he just knows that there's a guy back there flipping onion rings who you don't even think about, or, you know, you think that he's just a nice, normal guy. And no, he doesn't give a fuck. Just like me. Like this is who Americans are. Like, maybe it took people until the 2016 election or whatever to figure that out. But like, these are Americans are not always necessarily, you know, these 1950s paragons that we all want to pretend like we are.
The silent majority of just fucked up kids.
Yeah, for sure.
On that note.
I think it's your turn, Gary.
Let's do one more. Because this is all fun stuff. But I'm going to pick one that isn't my own. Okay, I feel like we've all been doing that. Although I think I just did. No, I didn't. This is one of Andrew's, I think. What badly dated 1999 trend would you like to see make a comeback? Badly dated 1999 trend. All right, so you wrote this one, Andrew. It seems like you have a lot of thoughts on this one.
Well, I don't have a lot of thoughts on this one, but one thing that I do find myself oddly nostalgic for is kind of like extraneous scratching on pop records. Stuff like on LFO Summer Girls or I think maybe even like Bewitched C'est La Vie maybe has a little scratching on it. Like just records that shouldn't have scratching that have really nothing to do with hip hop or like, you know, the Bronx or like, you know, DJ battles, sound systems, all that stuff. Like there's no reason for there to be scratching on those songs, but it had just become such an immersive part of pop music at the time and of pop culture. And it kind of just, it was like a very easy way to kind of lend yourself some very light modern cred and be like, oh, well, we're not your parents, you know, pop music, not your parents' boy band or, you know, the pop stars or whatever. And then to kind of show that you were down with hip hop, which was already starting to take over as the coolest music out there. So you just throw some scratching on there. Sugar Ray certainly had, I mean, they made a career out of like pop songs that had very light DJ elements. That was fun. I don't know. I mean, like it certainly like hit a peak of you know, mass consumption or whatever that meant that it had to go away for a while, and it certainly has. Like I think if you heard scratching on a record now, you would be like, oh, they're trying to be like 1999, or they're trying to be like the 90s, or maybe if they did it really well, they would say that they were trying to be like early hip hop. But I think we're ready for, you know, a little bit of a comeback. You know, it's a part of both pop music and of hip hop that's sort of, you know, lacking these days in sort of the live turntablism and elements like that. It'd be fun to get a little bit of a little taste of that again, maybe.
I guess I'll go with there were a lot of country remakes of pop hits sort of in the mid to late 90s.
Kind
of
started like with, I don't want to miss a thing.
Yeah, well, like all, with All for One and John Michael Montgomery trading off. But in 1999, we had, and I like both of these covers, Mark Chestnut's cover of Aerosmith's mm-hmm. I Don't Want to Miss a Thing, number one country hit. I guess I like my NSYNC collaborations from 99, Gloria Estefan, but also NSYNC in Alabama remade God Must Have Spent a Little More Time on You. So I just always thought it was a great way for the country to take advantage of a big, it was kind of goes back to the whole discussion.
Take advantage
to be able to play a song that's getting so much.
Open up those fences, country music.
Attention. But yeah, I just, what hit me too is there's a couple versions bubbling under the country airplay chart right now of Shallow. Danielle Bradbury does one of them, Abby Anderson, the other playing the Lady Gaga or the Ally role.
I did not know that.
What's kind of funny is I feel like country really could just play the original version. The instrumentation is country enough in its own version, but again, if it's more promoted through the typical Nashville channels, you have probably more of a chance to get on country radio. So yeah, just I'm not going to say it was badly dated because I always thought it was kind of a fun way for country to get it on the conversation a little bit more.
I think, and also I'll say I do miss singing. I do miss singing in a lot of ways because I think I'm not gonna say it was the last year we had like real singers hitting the charts, but there's some records out there. Like I was even just looking through this list, some of those falsettos, Fortunate, So Anxious, Too Good, people today. I mean, who has a good falsetto today? That's just something that
the same thing.
I mean, I guess you could say Robin Thicke has two, but who knows? Nobody's Supposed to Be Here. Even that those big gospel-y ballads that Andrew I think likes when they were turning into dance mixes.
I like the original versions too.
To get them some pop radio play, but I do miss that. I don't know. It's one of the last times I feel like for sure one of the last years before all the technology caught up with people, and that maybe the rise of the teen pop movement is partially to blame. That old guard of 90s R&B, really, a lot of them did not make it into 2000. They really got cut off at the 90s.
Yeah, and, I mean, this is the last big year for Whitney, certainly. With the It's Not Right, But It's Okay, and My Love Is Your Love. And I don't think she ever really has pop hits on that level again. And it's also the last big year for Celine Dion. She has yes. That's the Way It Is, and which was kind of carries over into 2000 as a hit. But that's her last visit to the top 10 too. So. Yeah, those are two of the ultimate powerhouse singers of that period, and then you don't really hear from them so much after that.
Yeah, and I mean, obviously Mariah came back, but she kind of hit that wall, yep. And in the same way too. And yeah, you get the new guard with Beyonce and a few others, but I think the focus becomes certainly a lot more on visual, way more than it does on voice.
And we should say also one of the biggest songs this year that I don't think we've mentioned yet on this podcast, "Cher's Believe," which introduces a new element into the mix.
Well, that's a good point.
An auto-tune, and certainly, you know, some sanding down some of those rough edges, it takes a lot of the mystery out of the kind of the big powerhouse pop vocal.
And it gave a lot of y'all careers.
Yeah, certainly true, too. And shout out to Kid Rock as well for only God knows why and his part in that movement. But, it was about to be a different time in pop music, and 1999 has a lot to do with the pivot there.
All right, from Mariah at the beginning of the podcast to Mariah 1999.
We are positioning this as a Mariah Carey pod. Of all the things, it always comes back to Mariah somehow, some way.
All right. Andrew, thank you for coming on the podcast. We'll give you last choice. What song from 1999 do you want to go on?
All right, well, we talked about it as both Trevor and my number one of the year, so let's hear some X Factor.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.